Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, December 6th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast first thing, this coming from KCRG. Warmer air is pushing in, and we're still watching weekend storm system trends. Temperatures will be well above normal to wrap up the work and school week, though the weekend looks to start off a little wet. The thick and gloomy low clouds of the past few days have moved on, with partly to mostly clear skies overnight that allowed temperatures to fall into the upper 10s to low 20s. Expect a chilly start to the day, but a southerly or southwesterly wind during the day should allow temperatures to bounce back to the upper 30s to mid 40s. Those winds will be a bit gusty at times, with gusts reaching 20 to 30 miles per hour between about noon and 6 o'clock p.m. tonight. This will hold wind chills back in the 30s during the afternoon. Mid to high-level clouds will be present throughout much of today, but partly to mostly clear skies return again tonight. Despite the clearing, warm air will continue to move into the region on southerly winds and should help keep the lows in the low 30s. This warmer start should be a launch pad toward notably warmer readings by Thursday and Friday, with highs each day in the low to mid 50s around the area. Sunshine will be common on Thursday, with clouds increasing on Friday. That really gives us something to look forward to. The increase in clouds precedes the arrival of a storm system for the start of the weekend. Recent trends with this system have moved toward somewhat lighter precipitation potential, with a somewhat faster progression of the system in general. Expect the potential for rain to move in on Friday evening and night, with an area of low pressure tracking over the eastern Iowa and western Illinois. As this low continues to move to the northeast into the Great Lakes and Canada, enough cold air could wrap in on the backside of it to allow precipitation to mix with or turn over to snow across parts of the area. Due to the faster trend seen in recent data, any snow or rain will be ending by Saturday evening, likely leaving the remainder of the weekend dry. This system still holds the potential to produce wintry impacts across the area on Saturday, though with lighter wintry precipitation amounts, those should generally be lesser. With the storm still a few days away, things could still shift and change between now and when it actually develops and arrives. Turning now to the front page of the Courier today, the headline is U.S. Sanctions Israel. Travel ban announced for extremist Jewish settlers in West Bank. This story comes from Matthew Lee of the Associated Press. And it begins with a grim picture with the caption, Palestinians lie on the floor at the hospital as they wait to be treated after being wounded in an Israeli army bombardment of the Gaza Strip on Tuesday. Dateline, Washington. In a rare punitive move against Israel, the State Department said Tuesday it will impose travel bans on extremist Jewish settlers implicated in a rash of recent attacks on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken announced the step after warning Israel last week that President Joe Biden's administration would take action over the attacks. Blinken did not announce individual visa bans, but Department spokesman Matthew Miller said the bans were implemented starting Tuesday and would cover dozens of settlers and their families, with more to come if the settler violence continued. He wouldn't give a number and refused to identify any of those targeted due to confidentiality reasons. The decision comes at a sensitive moment in U.S.-Israeli relations. The Biden administration has firmly backed Israel since it was attacked by Hamas on October 7th, even as international criticism of Israel has mounted. The Israeli embassy in Washington declined to comment on the development. In recent weeks, the administration has stepped up calls on Israel to do more to limit civilian casualties as the Israelis expand their offensive and target densely populated southern Gaza. The U.S. has refrained from outright criticism of that offensive. It has been increasingly outspoken, however, about settler violence in the West Bank and Israel's failure to respond to the United States' calls to stop it. Quote, "We have underscored to the Israeli government the need to do more to hold accountable extremist settlers who have committed violence attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank," Blinken said in a statement. Quote, "As President Biden has repeatedly said, those attacks are unacceptable," unquote. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said Monday that since October 7th, at least 8 Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed by settlers. The UN agency said it has recorded 314 attacks by settlers that have resulted in Palestinian casualties, damage to Palestinian-owned property, or both. One-third of the attacks included threats with firearms, including shootings, and in nearly half of the attacks, the settlers were accompanied or actively supported by Israeli forces. Quote, "Today, the State Department is implementing a new visa restriction policy targeting individuals believed to have been involved in undermining peace, security, or stability in the West Bank, including through committing acts of violence or taking other actions that unduly restricted civilians' access to essential services and basic necessities," Blinken said. He said the U.S. would continue to seek accountability for settler violence against Palestinians, as well as Palestinian attacks against Israelis in the West Bank, and Israel, particularly as tensions are extremely high due to the conflict in Gaza. Quote, "Both Israel and the Palestinian Authority have the responsibility to uphold stability in the West Bank," Blinken said. "Instability in the West Bank both harms the Israeli and Palestinian people and threatens Israel's national security interests." Also on Tuesday, Israel said its troops had entered Gaza's second-largest city as intensified bombardment sent streams of ambulances and cars racing to hospitals with wounded and dead Palestinians, including children, in the bloody new phase of the war. The military said its forces were, quote, "in the heart of Khan Yunis, which has emerged as the first target in the expanded ground offensive into southern Gaza that Israel says aims to destroy Hamas." Military officials said they were engaged in the most intense day of battles since the ground offensive began more than 5 weeks ago, with heavy firefights also taking place in northern Gaza. The assault into the south threatens to fuel a new wave of displaced Palestinians and a worsening of Gaza's humanitarian catastrophe. The United Nations said 1.87 million people, more than 80% of Gaza's population, have been driven from their homes, and that fighting is now preventing distribution of food, water, and medicine outside a tiny sliver of southern Gaza. New military evacuation orders are squeezing people into ever smaller areas of the south. Bombardment has grown fiercer across the territory, including areas where Palestinians are told to seek safety. In the central Gaza town of Deir al-Balah, just north of Khan Yunis, a strike Tuesday destroyed a house where dozens of displaced people were sheltering. At least 34 people were killed, including at least 6 children, according to an Associated Press reporter at the hospital who counted the bodies. Footage from the scene showed women screaming from an upper floor of a house shattered into a concrete shell. In the wreckage below, men pulled the limp body of a child from under a slab next to a burning car. At a nearby hospital, medics tried to resuscitate a young boy and girl, unmoving on a stretcher. Israel's assault and retaliation for Hamas's October 7th attack has killed more than 15,890 people in Gaza, 70% of them women and children, with more than 42,000 wounded, according to the health ministry in Gaza. The ministry does not differentiate between civilian and combatant deaths. It says hundreds have been killed or wounded since a week-long ceasefire ended Friday, and many still are trapped under rubble. Israel says it must remove Hamas from power to prevent a repeat of the attack that ignited the war. Next, photographers allege Hamas ties lead to Iowa AG warning. This filed by the Courier's Des Moines Bureau, Dateline Des Moines. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd led a joint letter warning four news organizations about concerns that freelance journalists who supplied photos of the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel may have ties to the terrorist organization. In the letter, Byrd and 14 other Republican state attorneys general argue that the news organizations may have provided material support to terrorists by paying for photographs from journalists with alleged ties to Hamas. The letter is addressed to officials at the New York Times, Associated Press, CNN, and Reuters. A November report from Honest Reporting, a pro-Israeli media watchdog, questioned whether freelance photojournalists for the organizations had advanced knowledge of the October 7th attack. The news organizations have denied they had any knowledge of the attack. One of those reporters, Hassan Eslaya, posed for a portrait with Haya Sinwar, a Hamas leader, in a resurfaced social media post. CNN and the AP, who ran Eslaya's photos, but said he was not working for them on the day of the attack, have since said they are no longer working with him. According to the New York Times, photojournalist Yosef Masoud, another reporter named by Honest Reporting, said he was awoken by rocket fire on the day of the attack. His first photos were taken 90 minutes after the attack began, and the Times denied he had any prior knowledge. The letter cites federal law that bars providing material support to terrorist organizations and notes that it is illegal under state law in Iowa as well. The letter goes on to say the news organizations are, quote, on notice, unquote. Iowa Democrat leader addresses students' pro-Palestine statement. This story was written by Aaron Murphy, Dateline Des Moines, saying it is, quote, not an easy situation to handle, and suggesting, quote, we are not all going to agree. Iowa Democratic Party State Chairwoman Rita Hart addressed the state's party recent condemnation of a pro-Palestine statement issued by college Democrats at the University of Iowa. During a meeting of the state party's leadership committee on Saturday, Hart addressed criticism of the state party's call for the resignation of leadership for the university Democrats, after the group released a pro-Palestine statement that originally included a phrase that has become considered anti-Semitic. The November 1st statement originally concluded with the line, quote, may every Palestinian live long and free from the river to the sea, unquote. The phrase, from the river to the sea, has historic pro-Palestinian roots, but also has been adopted by anti-Israel entities. The Anti-Defamation League and Jewish organizations classify the phrase as anti-Semitic. Upon receiving feedback on the line, the University Democrats changed it instead to read, quote, may every Palestinian live long and free. Nonetheless, the Iowa Democratic Party issued a statement condemning the University Democrats' statement and calling on the leaders who signed it to resign. Quote, let's be very clear. That is a call for Jewish genocide, and we wholly condemn that offensive language, Hart said in the statement. Some Iowa Democrats, including among party leadership, have pushed back on the state party's response. The party's Arab American Caucus criticized the state party and accused the party of misrepresenting the University Democrats' statement. Quote, "I understand that not everybody agreed with the way that was handled," Hart said during Saturday's meeting. "I want you to understand that that was not an easy situation to handle." Quote, "Not everyone is going to be in agreement on it," Hart said. "That's unfortunate, but I don't think there's any way that's not going to be true. We're not all going to agree on that," unquote. Hart said her hope is that while Democrats may disagree on whether the state's party's condemnation of the college Democrat statement was appropriate, that it can be a respectful disagreement that does not fracture the state party. Quote, "I know there is disappointment, and people have expressed that. I've listened. I hear the objections. I've tried to learn from this experience, and I hope we can all move forward together," Hart said. In an interview last week, University of Iowa senior and University Democrats treasurer Matthew Charles told the Courier Des Moines Bureau Hart didn't communicate with the students who signed the statement before she demanded they resign. Quote, "The part that is extremely harmful about their statement is that they didn't ask us to resign because we'd made a mistake or used a phrase that we shouldn't have used," Charles said. They said, quote, "Let's be clear, this is a call for Jewish genocide." Quote, "They're saying unambiguously, these people are calling for Jewish genocide, which obviously is not true," he said. "If anything, we made a mistake and used a few words that we shouldn't have," unquote. Newman Abuisa, chairman of the Arab American Caucus, continued that group's criticism during Saturday's State Leadership Committee meeting. He asserted that the group's statement was not anti-Semitic and that Palestinians are the ones who are currently suffering in the Israel-Hamas war. Quote, "We need to be more than welcoming to them. We need to protect them. We need to help them, and we really need to put an effort to support them any way possible," Abuisa said of the college Democrats. Hart said in recent weeks she has taken steps to create a stronger connection between the state party and college groups. She said she has made connections with Democratic students groups at Iowa, Iowa State, and the University of Northern Iowa, and hopes to create a standing series of periodic meetings to help the groups grow their numbers and resources. Quote, "I recognize, as many of you do, how important it is to have a good relationship and to foster the youth vote. These young people are the future of this party, and we need to have a good relationship with them, and we need to have a working relationship with them. And that's what we're going to have moving forward," Hart said. Quote, "We're all looking forward to making that relationship stronger as we move forward. That's the good news that has come out of what I would consider a very tough political situation," unquote. Coats for Kids provide a cozy Christmas for students at Fred Becker Elementary School. Story written by Angela Sturm McLaughlin. Dateline Waterloo. Some Fred Becker Elementary School students will have a cozier winter thanks to a visit on Tuesday from the Coats for Kids campaign. Julie and Bruce Ellers started Coats for Kids in 2012, providing 180 coats to students from low-income families. Over the last 11 years, the organization has given nearly 21,000 winter coats, boots, and snow pants to students at 34 schools in Cedar Falls, Evansdale, Gilbertville, Hudson, and Waterloo. And here we have a photograph of Fred Becker Elementary School fourth grader Kylie Linwood as she tries on a pair of snow pants provided by Coats for Kids on Tuesday in Waterloo. This year, the goal is to help at least 1,800 children from preschool to high school across Black Hawk County. At Becker Elementary, cafeteria tables were piled with coats and snow pants for students to choose from and try on. First grader Maya Johnson, 6, was excited about the coat choices. Quote, My favorite color is pink, but I also like blue and purple, said Maya, who was able to choose a Galaxy Prince-style puffer coat and matching pink boots. I love snow and can't wait to make snow angels. Surveying the students picking out items, family support worker Tiana Smart stressed how important programs like Coats for Kids are for children within the Cedar Valley. Quote, the gift of having a warm coat is like Christmas for these kids. They are able to play outside with their friends without having to worry about staying on the blacktop, she said. Leah Elizonder, 9, shared just how exciting it was to get a new pink coat. Quote, I felt like I was shopping. I had so much stuff in my hands, she said. Sometimes my family and I go on walks, and I can't wait to take a walk in my new coat, unquote. Leah's classmate, 8-year-old Kylie Harris, also was happy with her new items. Quote, getting new stuff today was fun, she said. The coat I had before, I didn't like because it was too big and bulky, and I didn't like the way it looked on me, unquote. Kylie was very proud of her shiny pink and silver coat that she was able to pick out. Quote, I can't wait to go out for a recess, she said. Donations are accepted year-round to make the winter gear purchases possible. A gift of $30 allows a child to choose a new, warm coat along with a hat, gloves, and a scarf. A gift of $50 covers a new coat, hat, gloves, scarf, and a pair of boots. For $70, a child gets everything needed to play in the snow. Coat, boots, snow pants, hat, gloves, and scarf. Contributions can be sent to the Waterloo Community Foundation at Post Office Box 1253 in Waterloo, Iowa, 50704, or go online to wlucommunityfoundation.org under the Give Now tab. Learn more about the organization online at facebook.com/coatsforkids.waterloo, and Coats is spelled with a K. Grid Lounge in Cedar Falls gives aspiring race car drivers a real simulation experience. This written by Andy Malone, and the dateline is Cedar Falls. Racing cars grab the attention of a lot of children. Zach Everman, a 2004 graduate of Dyke New Hartford High School, was one of them growing up. Now he and two other University of Northern Iowa graduates have founded Grid Lounge, which they believe is Iowa's only simulation racing lounge in Suite 103 at 100 East 2nd Street. Quote, I've always loved driving and have loved cars in general, he said. I've never been racing in real life before, but I was interested in that thrill, unquote. The Cedar Falls entrepreneur had played racing video games like Forza Horizon. That wasn't enough, though. He had to scratch an itch he had later in life, a desire to take his experience to another level without worrying about risks and the cost of owning such a vehicle. Quote, I'm not at a point where I'd pick up racing in real life with a wife and three kids, Everman said. Instead, the owner of Pixel Labs, an advertising agency a short walk away, decided 11 months ago that he'd build a simulator in the tight space under his basement stairs with a 34-inch monitor, steering wheel, set of pedals, and a seat to simulate that real-life challenge. Quote, the arcade games are not the same. The physics are not realistic, he said. Arcades are more about entertainment. Here, you feel like you're in a real car and you're driving actual cars and racing on actual tracks, unquote. Everman used the simulator to race with people from around the world, and within a few months knew he'd found his niche. But he felt the experience was meant to be shared with others. Of course, a friend or two could build their own simulators and could share in that spirit from remote locations. Quote, it's not the same as being right next to someone and being able to heckle them, he said. So he took his interest one step further with Grid Lounge. He wanted to create a destination and see if an audience or a community could be formulated here locally. Everman, Chief Executive Officer, and his business partners, Patrick Loonsman, Chief Financial Officer, and Rhys Reimers, Chief Technology Officer, held a soft opening on November 24th during the downtown Holiday Hoopla event. Quote, "Every race has a grid to start with, and we wanted this to be an inviting space for those who don't know anything about racing," Everman said about the name selection. The business, located in the Hertz Donut Building, had its grand opening Friday in a space formerly occupied by Hurling Hatchet, now its next-door neighbor. It is also open 1 to 10 p.m. today. Regular open racing hours will be 4 to 10 p.m. Tuesday through Friday, and 1 to 10 p.m. on Saturdays. Racers can make appointments or show up to see if there's a slot available to play. Members, however, will be allowed access outside of the normal hours, potentially as early as 6 a.m. The 1,100-square-foot space has six simulators equipped with an adjustable seat, a steering wheel, pedals, and 49-inch ultra-wide monitor. As long as a person is old enough and has legs long enough to effectively tap the pedals, they can play and choose from at least 165 different cars and 19 different tracks. Quote, "The steering, the pedals, and the monitor, it's all pretty sweet. It's accessible for everyone, just challenging enough to make it fun, but it's not like something you'll never figure out," said Rob Williams of Cedar Falls, who came with his 8-year-old son, Owen, who, quote, "will probably leave him in the dust," unquote. He added that it's more fun than the Wii video game console at home, and it's exciting to see Cedar Falls on the cutting edge of something like this, unquote. He mentioned Grid Lounge to a friend from Kansas City who didn't think his area had anything quite like it. Quote, "There's always that turn that gets you," said Aaron Jarnigan of Cedar Falls, who was competing alongside the father-son pair. Quote, "It's really addicting when you come across a new track and want to figure out how to do it well. And it's a super immersive experience. Time goes by fast," unquote. Drivers can compete against each other in real time at the lounge or play individually. They can also show up to watch their friends over their shoulders or on the 85-inch broadcasting monitor from a high-top table, coach, or ledge, allowing a group of at least a dozen or so to share in the experience together. Closed container drinks are sold. The lounge team is also working on partnerships with restaurants like Urban Pie for food ordering and drop-off. Quote, "It's an exciting opportunity for Cedar Falls to have this sort of experience with a friend as a bachelor party, a corporate party, or team-building exercise," said Lewinsman. Quote, "It comes without any risk, and you can drive cars and be on tracks from all over the world," unquote. The offerings go much further. They include leaderboards, driver performance index calculations, and other stats. To learn more, go online to gridlounge.co. Serious crash prompts residents and officials to look at safety of First and Union intersection, Cedar Falls. An impassioned group of residents turned the spotlight on the intersection of First Street and Union Road at Monday's City Council meeting. Sarah Tovia was severely injured in a crash there on November 11th. Speakers shared tales of close calls they experienced driving through the intersection. A few of the dozen or so supporters of Tovia and her family said irresponsible driving and poor visibility can make the spot hazardous. Tovia emotionally recalled the accident that reportedly sent six people to the hospital, including herself and her two young daughters. Quote, "I will never forget the shock and terror I felt right before the impact, the sounds of my girls screaming, crying, and seeing blood," she said. The council unanimously requested the engineering department explore possibilities such as a safety study or minor improvements at the intersection, which is under state jurisdiction. Council members also asked that a report be presented or other action considered as soon as the next meeting on December 18th. Quote, I thank everyone for coming to speak tonight because I think this intersection has been a bad intersection for a long time, said City Administrator Ron Gaines. I know in the past we've tried to put a little bit of pressure on the Department of Transportation, and it's fallen on deaf ears. I can tell you that this time we're going to be a little more relentless, unquote. Nicholas Humpall, an engineer with the Iowa DOT, affirmed Tuesday that a safety review is being considered, as well as the relocation of pavement markings and clearing of shrubs and trees near the right-of-way. And now, listeners, we would just like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, December 6th, on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, let's listen to this announcement.
Kate fell in love with her husband after one date, and with her son after one look. And she risked it all by trying meth just one time. Meth never, ever. Visit yourlifeiowa.org, brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial comes from the New York Times, written by Catherine Miller, the resolute Liz Cheney. There's a scene in Liz Cheney's new memoir, Oath and Honor, where she was still in Congress. She walks through the Capitol and into the Republican cloakroom, enters a phone booth, closes the door, and calls Mitch McConnell. There aren't so many people who can just call up Mr. McConnell, nor was this quite standard procedure on Capitol Hill, but, as she writes, quote, I had known Mitch McConnell for decades, unquote. In 2023, a lot separates Ms. Cheney from the average Republican politician. But reading her memoir, it's clear how unusual her position was in late 2020. A true insider who was also listening to and believing what was going on with Donald Trump and the conservative base. That combination seems to have inspired her, turning every key available to stave off Mr. Trump's efforts to subvert the outcome of the election, and inspired her overpowering anger toward Kevin McCarthy. This is someone who knows Secret Service agents personally, who texted late at night with Paul Ryan about the state of Mike Pence's mind, whose husband Philip Perry is so well acquainted with the former acting U.S. Attorney General Jeff Rosen that when Mr. Rosen was fending off Jeff Clark's deranged post-election plans at the Justice Department, he called to tell Ms. Cheney and Mr. Perry that Mr. Trump might fire him. How many people besides Ms. Cheney could help organize the writing of a letter emphasizing the importance of a peaceful transfer of power that was signed by every living defense secretary and published on January 3, 2021? And how many people could listen as their father called up Donald Rumsfeld on New Year's Eve and personally read the letter? Unlike a number of people at similar elevations of Republican power, however, she's never thought Mr. Trump would just fade away. That was clear in 2021. And while she's now writing with the benefit of hindsight, part of the reason she clearly understood Mr. Trump was she was actually listening to people at different levels of Republican politics in 2020, a secondary kind of awareness. In her role as conference chair, she heard from members about all manner of things related to Mr. Trump, including Mike Johnson's efforts to whip signatures for the amicus brief that challenged states' ability to oversee their own elections. She sat in her kitchen on December 12, 2020, watching a pro-Trump rally in Washington, then played back clips for her husband who said, quote, it sounds like they're advocating the violent overthrow of the government, unquote. She writes repeatedly of exchanges with constituents and donors in the months leading up to January 6th, in which people described conspiracy theories. This kind of enterprising spirit brought about her decision to call Mr. McConnell. Before reaching him, she had dialed into a conference call for Trump supporters to hear what was up. According to Ms. Cheney, who appears to be describing a call not previously reported, a Trump advisor described the alternate elector scheme during that call. Afterward, alarmed, Ms. Cheney writes that she quizzed the House parliamentarian about what would happen if Mr. Pence decided to not count the votes. Alarmed by his answers, she next called Mr. McConnell, who told her to talk to his chief of staff and the Senate parliamentarian. That was January 4th, 2021. Now, that part of it ended fine. Mr. Pence counted the votes. But the whole scheme underlines how fragile and chancy things became and, at times, remain. Liz Cheney, in a phone booth, calling up Mitch McConnell because nobody's quite sure what will happen if the vice president doesn't count the electoral votes. There's an echo here in McKay Coppin's recent biography of Mitt Romney, in which he recounts Mr. Romney and other senators asking the police where they should go next while fleeing the mob under the Capitol on January 6th. Quote, "The senators know," one of the officers replied. One of Mr. Romney's aides had to tell them, "These are the senators." Since January 6th, Ms. Cheney has emphasized the way that institutions require the people within them to actively make choices rather than passively accept events. Good norms and procedures are meant to guide people toward moral and responsible actions. So no one individual is required to act with any particular heroism. When and how exactly to oppose Mr. Trump has, even for this small group of conservatives who want to do it, never been entirely obvious, though. Politics can lean toward inaction. Action requires a choice. Mr. Coppins relays a story in his book about Beth Myers, who had worked for Mr. Romney for decades, and whose husband died suddenly around the time of Mr. Romney's election to the Senate. She wanted to persuade Mr. Romney to resist starting his Senate career in the passive background, and instead to challenge Mr. Trump. Quote, "I've been in a fog the last month," Ms. Myers wrote to him in an email. Quote, "But the desire for sane leadership from you was expressed by so many of the people who've been in contact with me," unquote. The cost of opposing Mr. Trump, or even being perceived as opposing him, increased over the years. This is the clearest with the people who, through no fault of their own, who end up falling onto the breach with Mr. Trump. Like the election officials and workers in Georgia and Arizona who became the subject of threats and conspiracy theories. A Georgia poll worker, Ruby Freeman, became afraid of sharing her own name. It's often true, too, for the otherwise anonymous people who volunteer to explain how things really were with Mr. Trump. To read the committee interview transcripts with Cassidy Hutchinson is to feel how isolated her life became. But even for the people like Mr. Romney and Ms. Cheney, who possess financial and political resources beyond those of many, their lives, according to these accounts, are now sometimes filled with panicked calls to and from family members about security. Far beyond losing the kind of power that Ms. Cheney gave up, seemingly to prove how worthless it was compared with establishing a real record of what happened on January 6th, some people who have opposed Mr. Trump have absorbed costs into their quality of life. We live in a dangerous world, fragile and chancy. The deluded man who hit Paul Pelosi in the head with a hammer managed to enter the Pelosi's home, possibly only because House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's full-time security detail was with her in Washington. There are millions of seams in life. Thinking about reinforcing all of them would drive a person crazy. On January 6th, watching TV, Dick Cheney, the former vice president, called his daughter and asked if she were watching Mr. Trump speak at the Ellipse. He then told her that Mr. Trump had said it was time to get rid of the Liz Cheneys of the world. Quote, "You are in danger," he warned her. Ms. Cheney is, correctly, concerned about who will and will not be there if Mr. Trump regains power to cut off his worst impulses and preserve the structure of constitutional government. We have an editorial from the Storm Lake Times Pilot, written by editor Art Cullen. More border talk. A group of senators is attempting to negotiate a bipartisan border security bill with the White House as part of a larger effort to fund wars in Ukraine and the Middle East. House Republicans insist that hardening the border must be included in any package, including one to keep the government open. Senate Democrats in difficult re-election campaigns, like John Tester of Montana and Sherrod Brown of Ohio, are open in order to get the crisis off the table for 2024. Arizona is a key swing state for presidential and Senate. It is more likely than not to fall by the wayside, like countless other efforts at immigration reform. The Senate is able to compromise, but the House derails practical solutions. For example, Democrats want to legalize Dreamers, undocumented immigrants brought here as children by their parents, and make them citizens. House Republicans refuse, despite tremendous support from the public for Dreamers. They want to talk about security only. So it goes, and so it has gone for decades. Each side preserves something to use as a foil in the next election. The difference this time may be that the House leadership is so extreme on this issue that it will shut down the government over it or abandon Ukraine. The bipartisan group of senators is looking at changing asylum rules to make it more difficult for refugees to find freedom here. Whatever is done in haste and panic will not be good for anyone. Immigration is too complicated and sensitive an issue to think we can solve it on the precipice of a government shutdown. To leave Dreamers out of the discussion demonstrates how unserious the House is about governing. Climate is driving a worldwide refugee crisis. Corruption, poverty, and violence are endemic in Latin America, much of it fostered by drug demand in the United States. We helped create many of the inequities by supporting banana republic dictatorships over long periods. All that cannot get sorted through in an omnibus spending package intended to defend Israel and Ukraine. It sounds as if the senators would allow a rewrite on human rights to satisfy their immediate political problems. At that point, we look more like Ecuador and less like the land of the free. Now back to local news from the Courier. Mother charged in death of Iowa 3-year-old. Dateline, Ida Grove, Iowa. An Ida Grove woman has been arrested and charged with the death of her 3-year-old son in May. Billy Moisier, 23, is charged with one count of child endangerment resulting in death, a Class B felony that carries a 25-year prison sentence. Moisier turned herself in on Thursday and was released from custody after posting a $25,000 bond. Her initial appearance is scheduled for Thursday. On May 4th, Moisier called 911 for first responders to come to her home in Battle Creek because her son, Jordan Reed, was unresponsive. The child was transported to Horn Memorial Hospital in Ida Grove and then to Children's Hospital in Omaha. He was pronounced dead on May 5th, and an autopsy was performed the following day by the Iowa State Medical Examiner's Office. The Ida County Sheriff's Office and the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation launched an investigation into Jordan's death. According to a complaint filed in Ida County District Court, Moisier told investigators she had driven home, found Jordan slumped over in his car seat when she arrived, and believed he had fallen asleep and strangled on the chest strap of his car seat. The autopsy concluded Jordan died of strangulation, but his injuries were not consistent with Moisier's explanation. In a September interview, Moisier admitted she had found Jordan hanging from the rear driver's side window, the complaint said, and witnesses had reported seeing Jordan with his head or upper body out of the same window during Moisier's drive home from Ida Grove to Battle Creek. Witnesses and videos found on Moisier's phone revealed she regularly left Jordan unsecured while driving. Now on the sports page, Farron's to haters, quote, "We've got great colors. Iowa's easy to spell." Story written by Jim Nelson. Underdogs and Cinderella stories are well loved, but for reasons Iowa head football coach Kurt Farron's can't put his finger on, college football fans are unhappy about the Hawkeyes' appearance in the 2023 Big Ten Championship game. Iowa, the champions of the Big Ten West, opened as 3 touchdowns plus underdogs to number 2, Michigan, for Saturday's 7 p.m. title game, which will appear on Fox. Quote, "People love not to love us," Farron's quipped Tuesday during his weekly press conference. Quote, "That's okay. It is what it is. I don't know. Maybe it's me. I think I'm a decent person. I don't know. But whatever," unquote. Farron's hinted that flash might be something to do with. In a world of spread offenses and high-scoring games, Farron's Iowa teams have never been instant highlight reel producers. Iowa plays field position. The Hawkeyes rely on a stout defense that bends but rarely breaks, or infrequently gives up big plays. And there is that guy named Torrey Taylor that boots the ball miles and miles. The way the Hawkeyes win is what many refer to as winning ugly. But let's be honest, it has looked a lot that way since Farron's teams have won since 1999. Yes, over the last 2+ decades, Iowa has won its fair share of blowouts, but that is not the norm. It's amazing how fans have gone from buying thousands of "Punting is Winning" t-shirts from Ray Gunn last year to hating how the Iowa Hawkeyes earned their way to Indianapolis this fall. When Iowa last played the Big Ten title game in 2021, 5 of its 7 conference victories were by 7 points or less, with the lone exceptions a 34-6 win over Indiana in the Hawkeyes' season opener, and an absolute beatdown of Maryland 51-14 on the road. Quote, "I think there's also a stylistic part, and maybe we're not pretty enough, or whatever it may be," Farron's admitted. "The object is to win games. Try to find a way to win. That's what you try to do. Our guys have done a pretty good job of that. We're proud of what we've done, and proud to have earned our way into this thing, the Big Ten championship game. And now we have a hell of a challenge on our hands." It is a challenge. Michigan has an elite offense and defense. Deacon Hill and Iowa's offense will have to provide more than what it has flashed to date. The Hawkeyes' second-ranked rush defense in the country will have its hands full with Michigan's ground-paving offensive line and 2-star running backs in Blake Corum and Donovan Edwards. That Wolverine rush game dominated as Michigan pounded the ball with 32 consecutive run plays in a dominating win over Penn State, and late in its win over Ohio State last Saturday, Michigan ran the ball on 2/3 its plays over its final 3 drives. Quote, "What we've been saying, we'd have to do everything right and probably force a couple of mistakes," Farron's said of a hypothetically blueprint to victory over the Wolverines, "and doing it with real precision, like a real high level of precision." Quote, "I think, too, when you get into a game like this with an opponent like this, it's got to be right on the," Raymond Berry said, "and you don't aim for the bullseye. It's the center of the bullseye." So yeah, Farron's gets the Hawkeyes are the underdog Saturday. He adds, that is historically the way Iowa is perceived when it has played in big games like this before, such as January 1st bowls or championship games. Farron says, if you don't embrace that role, you're probably going to be a loser. quote, you have to relish the opportunity, the challenge, and understand just how significant the challenge is going to be. Appreciate that and respect it, Parent said. That is why he doesn't understand the hate. Quote, I don't know why. We've got great colors. Iowa is easy to spell, Farron smiled. Number 3, Wartburg College, rallies from 18 down and tops UW-Whitewater in quarterfinals. Dateline Waverly. The third-ranked Wartburg College might have flinched first. The Knights, however, never wavered. Down 18, 21-3 early in the second quarter, Wartburg rallied for a 31-28 victory over fifth-ranked Wisconsin-Whitewater Saturday to win an NCAA Division III quarterfinal playoff game at Walston-Hoover Stadium. Quote, this team is special. Been special all year, Wartburg coach Chris Winter said. Quote, we have been in those situations before. This team just fights, believes in each other. What a special day. An awesome win for our program. Super exciting. The victory over the Warhawks, a national powerhouse who has appeared in the Division III semifinals 13 times since 2005, was the first in school history for Wartburg. The Knights lost to UWW in the 2014 national quarterfinal round and in the second round of the 2019 playoffs. Wartburg will host defending national champion North Central College next Saturday in the semifinals at 2:30 p.m. at Walston-Hoover. Quote, congrats to Wartburg on the win, UWW head coach Jace Randall said. They earned it today. They found a way to win and were the better team, unquote. Niall McLaughlin passed for 301 yards and 3 touchdowns, including a 7-yard toss to Hunter Klassen with 54 seconds left that proved to be the game winner. Quote, unbelievable play calling. Guys were making plays and the line was blocking their butts off, McLaughlin said of the game-winning drive. Quote, that is the fight we have. We are going to keep going until we have no fight left, unquote. The score, a halfback screen in the left flat, completed an 11-play, 78-yard drive that started with 3 minutes 56 left in the game. Twice on the drive, Wartburg converted on fourth down. On a 4th-and-4 from its own 44, McLaughlin hit Carter Henry over the middle for 29 yards to the Warhawks' 27. Then, on a 4th-and-2 from the 19, McLaughlin hit Thomas Butters in the left flat for 13 to the UWW 6. Quote, some great play calling on the throwback to Tom and the screen to Hunter to get us in the end zone, Winter said. Coach Wheeler deserves a ton of credit for those calls to make that happen, unquote. Wartburg's longest drive of the season, an 82-yard, 13-play drive to open the third quarter, gave the Knights its first lead of the game when Klassen scored on a 1-yard run to make it 24-21. The teams traded opportunities over the next 15 minutes, including Whitewater missing a 22-yard field goal wide left that would have tied the game in the opening 90 seconds of the fourth. The Warhawks retook the lead when Alec Ogden hit Thomas Coates for a 7-yard score with 8 minutes 11 seconds left. Ogden finished with 366 passing yards and 3 scores. Then the teams traded punts before Wartburg scoring drive. Whitewater had 54 seconds left and 2 timeouts remaining when it got the ball back. But on 3rd-and-10 at midfield, Preston Rochford picked off Ogden with 25 seconds left to steal the win. Quote, I was in tears, said Parker Rochford, who led Wartburg with 11 tackles and is Preston's brother. Quote, he has worked to get where he is at. To make that play is awesome for him, unquote. Klassen finished with 117 rushing yards, and his rushing touchdown in the third quarter tied a school mark for rushing touchdowns in a season at 22. He had also had 6 catches for 54 yards and 2 scores. Quote, "Being honest, I was a little nervous," Clawson said of the early deficit. "We hadn't gotten a good drive going. They had been stopping us. But we executed our game plan on that last drive, and that is what we needed," unquote. Whitewater hit multiple big plays in the first half to surge to an early 21-3 lead. On the third play of the game, the Warhawks flanked running back Tamir Thomas out wide, and he ran a straight go pattern, beating his defender and catching a 69-yard pass in stride for a 7-0 lead just 1 minute 23 seconds into the game. Wartburg responded with a long 13-play drive and got a career-long 42-yard field goal from Cale O'Neill. Quote, "The fact that we fought back with a couple of scores in the second quarter and the start of the third quarter was a big thing to keep the momentum on our side," Winter said. Quote, "Hats off to Whitewater. They came in with a great game plan. They had us on our heels early. They did a good job of scheming us up, made some big plays on offense. They opened it up on us, and it was looking a little bleak," unquote. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, December 6th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.